Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you have questions you'd like to ask on the air about the Bible or the Christian faith, anything related thereunto, or if you have a difference of opinion with the host and would like to discuss that, this is a good place you can do it, a good opportunity. Rather than, for example, by writing emails of your disagreement, I'd much rather talk to you in real time, if possible. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Now, I'm going to give that number again. Our lines are almost all open. We really have most of them open right now, but that is going to change very soon, I would imagine. So if you're going to get through, this is the best time. Call 844-484-5737. And we have, coming up day after tomorrow, Saturday morning, in Southern California, we have a men's Bible study in Temecula. This occurs on the third Saturday of each month. Normally, on the third Saturday of each month, we also have an evening meeting in Buena Park. That's not going to be happening this weekend, nor in December. So the Buena Park meeting is on hiatus briefly until at least next year, but we still have the men's Bible study coming up this Saturday morning. If you're interested in joining us, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and under announcements, you'll find the date, the time, and the place of that gathering in Temecula this Saturday morning. All right. We're going to go to the phones and talk first of all to Michael from Everett, Washington. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, hi. Thanks so much for being there. I love your show. You know, I have a friend. He's about 60 years old. He's a dynamic corporate worker, has a family, and he's trying to put his kids through college. And he was recently laid off a few months ago. And so he's looking for work, and he's very stressed. And I want to be able to encourage him. And my question to you that I wanted to ask your feedback on is, does God have a plan for him, corporate, you know, a job-wise? And why I'm a little confused is, like, I know that in the Old Testament there are verses that say, you know, we take the actions, but the results are God's. And then I know, like, in the New Testament there's a verse, I think, that says, hey, we have, you know, the works of our hands are established prior to our birth, you know. And then I think of Jesus and Paul, and they kind of took jobs to fund their ministry. So I'm a little confused by it. I just would love your feedback. I want to be able to encourage him in terms of how to be peaceful during the process. I'd love you. Let me hear your thoughts.
Okay. Well, I'm a little confused by the question. You say he was laid off at age 60 from a corporate job. Is that correct?
He's 60. He was laid off a few months ago, yes. So now he's looking.
And his financial stress is due to his trying to put his kids through college?
Yeah, like he's got a mortgage. He's got, tuition to pay. So he's got pretty high expenses.
Then I have to ask, is he a follower of Christ?
Yes.
Okay. And so does he know the promises of God in Scripture, that if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all these things will be added to you, Jesus said? I think that if people seek the kingdom of God first, there's a promise that everything you need will be added. Now, the context of that promise, of course, is that if you need, you know, God provides food and clothing. Jesus gives the example of how he feeds the birds and how he clothes the flowers, the field with the beautiful garb, and that, you know, people are worth a lot more to God than birds and flowers are. So we have very little faith if we think that he won't take care of us. But, of course, many of us are not satisfied with food and clothing. And I would say shelter is pretty much a need, too, and that's probably implied in there as well. But what Jesus teaches, of course, is that God will provide our needs, but our idea of our needs and God's idea of our needs may be very different. You know, Paul said in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he said, having food and clothing, with these we will be content. So, I mean, God will provide our food and clothing as long as he wants us to live, and he'll provide everything we need. But we have to learn to be content. If he's had a very high-paying job, and he might have a really expensive house, I don't know. You know, he's got a mortgage still he's paying. You know, he's putting his kids through college. These are expenses that, you know, God may or may not see as needful for his calling. Now, I do believe that God calls some people to live, you know, to live in more expensive dwellings than, for example, I feel like I've ever been called to live in. And I believe God calls some people to go to college. So, I mean, if that's God's will, he'll provide for those things. Now, if he finds that God doesn't provide for those things, that's really not any evidence that God isn't taking care of things, because we've been told to be content with our sustenance. If God takes care of everything that keeps us alive, then God has done everything he's promised to do. And we can count on him doing that. But, of course, people do experience reversals sometimes. Sometimes they have a health crisis. In his case, he's been laid off. He's 60 years old. It may or may not be possible for him to get another job that pays as much as he's accustomed to making. You know, there are things that happen to people. There have been things that happen to me that can be seemingly career-ending. And yet God, if we're looking to God, if we're pursuing his kingdom and his righteousness, as he said to do, if that's our whole desire, is that his will be done in our lives, and we're willing to accept his will, even if it's, let's just say, maybe less profitable, less prosperous than our preference would be. Well, God always keeps his promises. I can guarantee you that. I mean, I've lived by faith for 50-something years, and I know that God does not fail to keep his promises. But a lot of times, we've made our own plans for our lives. I mean, for example, if I wanted my kids to go to college, and I'm not sure why a Christian would want them to, unless they need, you know, a college-educated career. For example, if someone's going into the medical field or law, or, you know, there's lots of fields that you can't get into without a college degree. But I would say the vast majority of fields that people go into after they've been through college, you really didn't need a college degree for that. And going to college, we sometimes have had the impression that people just need to go to college. You know, once they're out of high school, put them through college, that's the best way to spend the next 4 or 6 years, and then they'll get a better job. Well, that conventional wisdom is no longer really true, and it may not be God's will for them to be in college. However, since they're young adults, I mean, if they're college age, they're young adults, it's now time for them to trust God for his will for their life. Now, I never went to college. My wife got a master's degree and put herself through college. She didn't have people paying her fees after her freshman year, but she worked sometimes 2 or 3 jobs to put herself through college. People don't want to do that anymore, but that's what people often did in the past and can still do. If he can't afford to put them through college, I'm not sure why he should think it's his obligation to put them through college. A, God may or may not want them to go to college. And B, if he does want them to go to college, he can make a way for them, whether it involves your friend's money or not. There are other ways to do it besides having your parents carry you through college. So I just have a totally different worldview than many Americans do. Many Americans just feel like, you know, we should live at least middle class. I don't think we need to live middle class. We can live below middle class. You know, we should all, you know, our kids should go to college. Well, I don't know that I want my kids going to college. The colleges are there primarily today to indoctrinate them with woke cultism. I don't know why I put my children under that kind of teaching. If my kids are to go to college, I don't see why that's my obligation to put them through. That's they're adults. You know, when the kids are out of high school, they are adults. And many people their age have put themselves through college. Now, as far as your friend goes, I would just encourage him to learn to trust God in general. Of course, if he's highly stressed, it's because he was well-employed for a long time, he has never become accustomed to having to trust God. That's I'd suggest a very large number of Christians in America are in that condition. We've lived in prosperous times the last 50 years. Since World War II, we've had the most prosperous nation that ever was on the face of the earth, and even middle-class people have had lots of expendable money. Well, that may be changing. Our economy is different. The nation has turned against God. The nation may go into depression. Who knows? I don't know what's going to happen, but we certainly cannot live our lives assuming that the comforts and luxuries we've had due to the world that our parents, in a sense, gave us, that those are going to continue in this corrupted world that we've provided for our children. We might just have to live differently than we've been accustomed to. But that's okay, because it's almost in the definition of being a Christian. And the definition of being a Christian is being willing to live differently than what you're accustomed to. You're living for God. And God doesn't always have a life without changes in it through a lifetime. So I probably don't sound like I'm being very sympathetic. I am. It'd be a very hard trial, I'm sure, for someone who's provided for his family and himself and has bills and so forth and had a good paying job to suddenly find himself without it. But if I were in that position, and I never will be because I've never had a good paying job, but if I were in that position, and this happened to me, I would tell myself, okay, I need to reevaluate my standard of living. Maybe God will provide me a job where I can continue in my present standard of living. That'd be fine. Probably that's the easiest thing. But at age 60, maybe not. Maybe I won't find a job like that. And therefore, I need to adjust my expectations. I may need to reduce my standard of living. I may have to tell my kids that they're going to have to be responsible for their lives now that they're adults, including their college education if they're going to go to college. I mean, those are things I would do, and I would do those because I would always be thinking about what does the Bible say about finances and about God's will and things like that. I figure that God will provide for you to live whatever life standard of living that he wants you to live. And if he provides less than you thought, then your standard of living probably should be less than you were expecting. And that's not the end of the world. I myself have lived in a VW bus for months at a time. Not recently, but I've lived in poverty much of my adult life. I'm not poor now, but I've spent decades raising my kids at the poverty level. And I never had any complaints about it because, as Paul said, having food and clothing with these will be content. And being content is much more gratifying than being rich. A lot of people who are rich are not content. I'd much rather be content at any level of standard of living than be rich and not content. So teach him to be content, trusting God that God's will be done. If he's seeking God's will, if he seeks the kingdom and God's righteousness, then he has absolutely nothing to worry about. That's what I would tell anyone in his position. Though I am sympathetic toward the changes and the struggle that in his mentality that it'll be. It's hard to make those kind of changes, especially when you're older. But anyway, that just comes with the territory of living in the real world and not having all the props that our previous generations left to us after World War II. The luxury we've had has been, I think, part of the blessing of God that came with a nation that in some measure was standing for righteous things and biblical ideas. We now have a nation that's throwing those things off. And everyone may suffer economically for that, including those of us who love God. But those who love God and trust him will never lack for anything that God really wants us to have. All right, let's talk to Rick from Phoenix, Arizona. Rick, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I have a family member who feels that it's not right to attend a church where the pastor is paid by the church. What does the Bible speak to regarding that? Could you expound on that?
Okay. Well, I don't think it's wrong to attend a church which has things about it we don't agree with. I mean, there might be some things that are an abomination in a church that we would not feel comfortable at all going to that church because we'd feel like we're taking sides with God's enemies because of the abominable things they're doing. And there are churches like that. that a pastor would be paid by the church is not an abomination to me. I don't believe it's the way of Christ. That is, Christ told his disciples in Matthew chapter 10, freely you've received, freely give. Now, for example, I never paid any money to become a minister, and therefore I can't charge money for my ministry. I received freely this ministry, and I am told to give freely, which is what I've done for the past 52 years and will do till the day I die. Many pastors might say, well, I didn't get this freely. I went to seminary. I have you know, college bills and things like that. I need to repay. I mean, I understand. I understand if you took that route, which is not the route that I took or would recommend, but if someone took that route and they've got bills, I could see why they might say, well, I didn't freely receive, so I can't freely give. On the other hand, if one is in the ministry because Christ has called him to the ministry and is doing the will of God in the ministry, Christ will provide, just as I said to the previous caller. If a pastor's role in the church is the role that God has for him, then God will provide for him. I don't think it has to be through a salary. And I would prefer that it would not be. I would never charge a salary only because I couldn't distinguish between that and having being a contract laborer for a church. When you're in the ministry, you've got a choice. You can serve God, and servants serve without pay, but they are supported by their masters. Or you can be a contract laborer and a professional and work for an organization called a church, and you haven't got to deal with them. You work this many hours, and they give you this much money, just like any other contract laborer in any other field. I don't think that Jesus intended for his disciples to be in that latter condition. But in the past 2,000 years, well, I shouldn't say 2,000 years, probably the last maybe 1,700 years, the church has evolved into an organization that does have professional clergy. Any pastor today who's receiving a salary probably never crossed his mind not to. Probably he was raised in a church where the pastor had a salary, and his pastor probably was raised in a church where the pastor had a salary, and probably going back many generations, everyone they've known in pastorate had salaries. Now, there are, of course, some churches that don't pay salaries because they're so small and poor, and the pastors, they agree to, you know, pastor the church, but they also hold jobs on the side. And this is, you know, this is very admirable, I believe. But the idea of being a full-time pastor and not being salaried is kind of a foreign idea in the American church and probably the modern church everywhere in the world, especially in the Western world. But biblically, I do believe that a man who's doing the will of God does not have to become a contract laborer to any organization. He can serve God, and God will provide. And I don't say that as a theorist. I say that as somebody who's lived that way for 52 years, or 53. So, you know, I know this is true, but many pastors don't know it's true. And many pastors don't know anyone else who knows that it's true. It simply is the culture, the church culture of the past several centuries that assumes that being a pastor is as much a job as being a college professor is being a job. Or being an executive of a corporation is a job. And that's partly because churches are viewed as corporations today. This was not so in Jesus' day or in the first several centuries. And I don't see any reason why it should be so. Now, having said all that, I've made it very clear that I think a pastor would be better served and more like the ministers of biblical times if he lived by faith and didn't have a salary. But if it was very clear to the people that he ministered to that he depends on God to supply his needs, and they are the ones that God will use to do it. I'm not going to condemn any man who does it a different way. I actually pity him because I would hate to have the bondage of being a salaried minister. And some people might say, well, that's just because you're rebellious. Well, I might be a little rebellious, but that's not why. I wouldn't want the bondage of being a salaried minister because then I have to please men rather than God. And Paul said in Galatians 1:10, if I was still trying to please men, I couldn't be the servant of Christ. And I'll tell you right now that some of the things I believe and teach, I have a very hard time finding a church that wanted to salary someone to say those things. But fortunately, I don't have to. because I'm not under anyone's salary. I just serve God, and I think every pastor could do that. Now, should a person not go to a church because the pastor does have a salary? I've never made that a sticking point for me. I think almost every church I've gone to, the pastor has a salary. And, you know, if he asked my opinion, I would tell him, you know, I think it'd be a lot greater if you didn't have a salary. But I'm not going to judge you for it. I mean, that's between you and God. That's not me to judge another man's servant. But I would prefer that every pastor was living by faith. For one reason, it would mean they really were Christians. I'm not saying a person who's a Christian can't live otherwise than by faith, but I would say it would take a real Christian to actually live by faith, because, you know, otherwise you get people going into ministry as a career, as a job, expecting to make a living at it, and so forth. And frankly, all kinds of motivations and stuff can assail a man's heart when that is his situation. So I just think pastors would be freer. They'll be happier if they weren't salaried. And it'd be much more like what Jesus said. Freely you've received, freely give. That means don't charge for it. But I'm not another man's critic about this. I'm very happily a practicer of a different policy. Now, if I like a church, I'm not going to judge the church because the pastor's on salary. I'm not even going to judge the pastor. I might feel sorry for him, but I could still respect him. And, I believe it's a blind spot, and I believe that it's forgivable because it is a blind spot. But it's very, very different than the early church. But then almost everything about our modern churches are very, very different than the early church. I believe that the patterns of the early church were abandoned very early on in the early second century. And I don't know of many churches that have returned to the standards of the early church. I think the church would be healthier if they did. But let's face it, we've got to live with what we've got, unless we've got in the position to start a new church that's somehow, you know, much more like the early church. But, I mean, good luck finding one. You might start one in your home, but, if I go to a church, I almost expect that the pastor's probably on salary there. That I know of very few exceptions. And I don't hold it against him. There's far more important things to me than whether the pastor's getting a salary or not. So if you know somebody who says, I won't go to church because the pastor's salaried, I would say I'd have to have more reasons than that. There's lots of churches with salaried pastors I wouldn't go to, but not because of that, but because of other things in the church I don't like or don't think are God-honoring. But if a church is otherwise God-honoring, I'm not going to judge a pastor who happens to have a predictable salary. That's between him and God. So I'm not for this idea of leaving the church because the pastor is salaried. But there might be other reasons to do so. That'd be my whole spiel on that. I appreciate your call. Marianne from Michigan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Okay. My question is, I'm concerned about Islam. Maybe you could shed some light about Islam. And what I mean is, from what I understand, and I've got some passages on my phone, it's okay to kill infidels. So I think infidels are non-believers or believers of other religions.
People like
that. I don't think people in the world fully realize. To me, it's kind of like a danger.
Right.
Just a little nervous. I don't know. Maybe you could shed some light. It seems we could end up eventually in a religious, like a holy war.
The early church in Jerusalem lived among religious people who believed in killing them for being heretics. The Jewish religion, they stoned Stephen as a martyr because they thought he was a heretic. They commissioned Saul of Tarsus to go out and arrest and kill other Christians for the same reason. So, I mean, early Christians lived in a society where the predominant religion did believe in killing those, you know, who deviated from their religion. Just like if we lived in a, let's say, you know, Iran or somewhere like that, and the dominant religion there believed in killing us because we're Christians. Christianity is the one religion, at least, that should never agree with killing people who disagree with them. but it's the world we live in. Now, Islam does not control America at this point. It's not a dominant religion here. It's growing in its influence. And not all Muslims are interested in killing heretics. Some are. There are radical Muslims that want to, you know, carry out the Quran and Sharia law to the letter, in which case they would have to agree to kill people like you and me. But most Muslims are not in that mindset. And so even if we had probably 10 times as many Muslims as we have now, we probably could still live on the same street with a Muslim and they wouldn't come to our house and kill us. But it is true. There are people who take that form of Islam that does believe that all heretics or all unbelievers who are not Muslims should be killed. And if you lived in a country where they were dominant, yeah, it'd be a little bit concerning. On the other hand, Jesus said, "He that seeks to save his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake shall find it." So Jesus basically indicated it's kind of normal, really, for the Christian to be threatened, even have their life threatened for their faith. We're not used to that in this country, and maybe we never will have to be, but maybe we will. If so, we'll be about like most Christians throughout history who lived among people that were many times willing to kill them for their faith. I'm sorry I have to take a break. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you'd like to call and talk about those, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller today is Bruce, calling from Garden Grove, California. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes, I heard from a friend who's, of course, sort of charismatic. He said he believed that the mark of the beast was taking the jab, so to speak, the COVID-19 vaccine, and his rationale was it changes your DNA. I don't know if there's any scientific evidence to that, but it'd be interesting. And he said that, you know, you wouldn't appear to God as a regular human being. Have you ever heard of this theory? And have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've certainly heard of that theory. First of all, as far as the scientific information, whether, you know, the COVID vaccine actually changes your DNA, I have heard that from people who can talk more convincingly about it than I can. I don't know if they're right. I just don't know. I mean, I'd have to do like my own research on that as a scientist. I'd probably have to look at people's DNA and things like that to know if that really happened, because the internet has so much information that's misleading. I simply don't know which to believe about whether that happens. Now, some people say that when you get the jab, it changes your DNA and you become a transhuman and you're not really strictly a human being anymore because your DNA has changed. Well, obviously, that's going a little far. I mean, even if our DNA were changed, that doesn't change who we are, because our body is not us. We are living in our bodies and we're present in the body. But when we die, we'll be absent from the body and present with the Lord, which means we live in this body. And even if something like that, if some change like that could happen, then that changes our bodies. That changes this earthly tent that we're living in. It doesn't change who we are. We're present in the body, but it wouldn't change who we are. We'll still be absent from the body when we die. Now, I will say this. I don't know enough about science, And I certainly don't know the data, so I cannot speak knowledgeably at all on what the vaccine does. It seems strange to me that anything could be put in my body that would change the DNA in every cell in my body. We got billions of cells in our bodies. I'm not sure how injecting something into my arm would rearrange the DNA in every single cell in my body. And I'm not sure how many cells would have to be affected for it to be significant. But I don't worry about those things. For one thing, I'm just not really worried about my body that much. I mean, I don't want to get sick or anything like that. But the mark of the beast has nothing to do with your DNA. The mark of the beast in the Bible is, I believe, siding with the anti-Christian government. I think that's what it basically is. The anti-Christian government is the beast, I believe. And the mark of the beast is, I don't believe it's a literal thing in the hand or the forehead. And by the way, even those, I didn't get the vaccine, I don't plan to, but those who did, I don't know if any of them got it in their hand or in their forehead. I suspect not. So, you know, the hand and the forehead in the Bible are, I believe, symbolic for the thoughts and the actions. Your hands are your actions. Your hands represent your works, the works of your hands. And your forehead is that which is in the forefront of your mind. So it's your thoughts and your actions. If they are not conforming to those approved by the anti-Christian state, then I think that's what the mark of the beast is. I don't think it has to do with anything that's injected or anything that's put on the body. Again, I don't believe that the physical body and anything that's done to it is ever going to have any impact on people's salvation. It's your heart. It's where your heart is. It's where your thoughts are. It's where your loyalty is. That's what affects salvation. So, you know, I think that people who say that, first of all, they're believing things about the vaccine that I can't personally verify, and I wouldn't affirm them because I don't know them to be true, and it's a distraction of sorts because, you know, let's face it, some people have gotten the vaccine. If it changed their DNA, they probably haven't noticed, and many people have had that vaccine for a couple of years now, and I mean, maybe it might kill them, it might do harm to them in some way. I don't, you know, it could be obviously a delayed impact, but as far as their DNA being changed, I don't know if they've ever. I don't know how much that's been proven. I don't care. If they made me get it, I mean, I'm totally against getting the vaccine, but if they held me down and put it in my arm, I wouldn't worry because it's not my choice. You know, I'm not worried about what happens to my body, actually. I actually plan to die someday and probably not too long hence. But my concern would be with my heart, and that's where the mark of the beast would be relevant. Is my heart with the Lord, or is my heart with the world system? And I think that's what that's about. It's, yeah, the dispensationalists believe that the mark of the beast is something that will be actually done to your body, a mark, a chip, something, an injection or something. But I don't believe that the mark of the beast in Revelation, the only place that mentions the mark of the beast is Revelation 13:18, and I don't believe that it has anything to do with something done to your body, literally. I believe there's symbolism in Revelation. So I guess my answer would be no, I don't agree with that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Bruce. God bless. Nicole from California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Steve. So my question was actually about women in ministry and specifically about women being able to marry couples. And I was able to go on the website, but I just got that Paul says it shouldn't be elders or teach. So I was wondering kind of what your take is on this.
Well, Paul did not allow women to be elders in the church.
Right.
Elders are what they had in the early church instead of what we call a pastor. Now, some churches today have a pastor and they have elders. In the early church, they had only elders. They didn't have anyone called a pastor. The elders, as a group in every church, were told to pastor the church, to shepherd the flock. So the shepherding body in the early congregations were the eldership rather than some individual pastor. Now, when it comes to qualifications for elders, Paul talks about these, obviously, in 1 Timothy 3 in the opening verses and also in Titus chapter 1. In both places, he makes it very clear he does not have women in mind for those roles. He wants them to be husbands of one wife. He wants them to be heads of households, which, according to Paul, would be the husband's job. Paul didn't put women in that position, and I don't know that we should go against him on that. I personally wouldn't put women in that position either. Not because I don't think women can be good ministers. I'm sure they can be. There's many ministries that women can be in. But being an elder of a church or a pastor is one of those that Paul wouldn't let them in. Now, Paul was happy enough for women to teach other women, as he says in Titus 2:4, or for them to teach children, or for them to be prophetesses, which Paul thought was the greatest of the gifts, being a prophet. Or certainly Paul would not hinder them from being what Jesus said was the greatest role, which is that of a servant. I think Paul would allow them in that role. That includes being deaconesses, because the word deacon is diakonos in Greek, means a servant. So there's lots of roles, missionaries, evangelists. The first evangelists were women at the tomb of Jesus. The angels commissioned the women to go and evangelize the apostles. So the apostles were evangelized by women. So obviously women can do very many significant things. It's just being a pastor or an elder is not one of those things biblically. Now, on the other hand, when it comes to conducting marriage, the Bible never says anything about anyone conducting a marriage. We traditionally would have a pastor or a priest in the Christian church, conduct the ceremony, and I've got nothing against doing that. Secular people have sometimes used a judge, a justice of the peace or whatever. That can be done, too. In the Bible, at least in Old Testament times, we don't know who officiated, if anyone, at the weddings. We know the Jews eventually had a tradition about weddings and so forth. We don't know how early they developed. Back in Genesis, they didn't seem to have an officiant at the wedding of, for example, Rebekah and Isaac. An arrangement was made between the two families. The girl agreed to it. Isaac accepted what he got through the negotiations of his family members. And it says when she came from her homeland and he met her, he took her into the tent and they were married. We don't read of any ceremony at all. However, while the Bible doesn't really lay out any ceremony, the Bible makes it very clear that a marriage is contracted when two people make vows to each other, vows of marriage particularly. Marriage is a covenant. When people get married, they are making a lifelong commitment. And this commitment is made not by some minister who officiates. It's made by them vowing lifelong loyalty and fidelity to each other. So those are the vows. Now, I do believe that those vows should be witnessed, and I have nothing against there being somebody officiating, a pastor or somebody else. Sometimes it might be the bride's father or someone else, but all of that is really in the realm of people's choice about that, because the Bible doesn't ever speak about anyone officiating at any weddings. I'm sure that most weddings throughout history probably did have an officiant overseeing and running the ceremony. That's just one way to make something be orderly and make sure that nothing is left out that should be included. But typically, if two families, the family of the bride and the family of the groom, got together and witnessed them making vows that contained all the promises that are related to marriage, I would consider that couple married. That's exactly what happened in many cases in Old Testament times, and I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be legitimate today. I personally think that Christians ought to always be part of a Christian fellowship, and I think that they ought to take their vows in front of that fellowship because they're going to become a couple in the fellowship, and I think the people in the fellowship need to know and hear that they made these vows and hold them accountable for them. So I believe in public ceremonies. But who officiates, as far as God is concerned that we know in the Bible, it doesn't matter who does that. Anyone could feed them the vows. Now, if someone says, I want a woman to do it, I guess perhaps the only discomfort I might feel about that is that traditionally most people expect, if you're in a Christian church, that probably a pastor in the church is going to officiate. Now, this doesn't have to be such, but that's what almost all people assume. And seeing a woman officiating might give many of those who attend the impression that that she's the pastor of the group. I mean, it could be told them that she's not, but I could easily see a misunderstanding on the part of some of the guests there. But I can't see anything in the Bible that would forbid, if the officiant at the wedding is simply saying, now you give your vows. Okay? I mean, usually at a formal wedding, the minister also says something like, by the authority invested in me since I live in California, by the state of California, I pronounce you man and wife. Well, that's doing it for the sake of the state of California and for the marriage license and so forth. If people want to get that kind of a marriage license in California, I suppose they can. But not every person could just stand up and say, I'm speaking in the name of by the authority of the state of California, because the state of California only authorizes some people and not all people to do that. But if you're not worried about the state, recognizing it, then as far as God's concerned, there's nothing that says that anyone else in particular has to officiate at the wedding. All right. Thanks for your call. Let's talk to Brad from Walnut Grove, California. Quite a few California calls. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Steve. Hi, Steve. How you doing? I was on the YouTube. I love YouTube because there's so many things you can explore. But I've never done much exploring or understanding about the Orthodox Church. And this guy YouTube kept suggesting that I watch it. So one day I started watching it, and I was kind of impressed with their belief system and how really traditional that they are. And just wanted to get your take on it, on what you thought about it. I mean, there's a lot of people that are against it, like John MacArthur and other pastors that have spoke out against it, but I really don't see anything that's out of line with what the Bible teaches us. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I'm no expert on the Orthodox Church, though I have, of course, known a number of people who've moved in that direction and become Orthodox out of evangelicalism, as I have also known some evangelicals who've gone toward the Catholic Church. Now, I have great disagreements with the Catholic Church, and many of those disagreements I'd have with the Orthodox Church, too. Now, I will say this, none of these people have any obligation to honor my objections, because they don't answer to me. They answer to God. I can't tell you that God is against them going into the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Church just because I'm against it. I certainly believe many people in these churches are true followers of Christ. And while many evangelicals or Protestants say, how dare you say that a person who's a Catholic or Orthodox can be a follower of Christ? Well, I ask, well, what church do you go to? Is your church following Christ completely? I mean, if you have some differences between the traditions of the Orthodox or the traditions of the Catholics and what you think Scripture teaches, I'll bet I could find some differences between the traditions of your group, your Protestant group, and what the Scripture teaches. It probably wouldn't take long to find them. Unfortunately, I don't know of any church groups that follow, the Bible in every respect without any kind of tradition. Now, I will say some have more reliance on tradition than I feel comfortable with. The Roman Catholic Church, for example, specifically believes that church tradition, even if it's not biblical, is as authoritative as Scripture. That's where they differ from Protestants. Now, I think the Orthodox feels similarly about that, maybe not so much as the Catholic Church does. The Orthodox don't have a pope, which is an improvement over Roman Catholicism, I think. But in many respects, all the same things that I would object to in the Catholic Church, you'll find in the Orthodox Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church is very much the Catholic Church without a pope, though they have other differences, too. One reason they split apart, I don't think it was the only one, is that the Catholic Church believed in having images in the church, and the Orthodox Church thought they should have icons instead. Well, what's an icon? An icon is a piece of wood with a painting of a saint on it. And the Catholic Church, instead of having those, has images, statues of saints. And so they actually split over something like that. And I consider that, you know, having pictures of saints or statues of saints is no normative part of, you know, first century Christianity. And in at its worst, it can be seen as idolatry. I'm not saying everyone who has a statue in their church has an idol in their church. It depends on if people are worshiping it or not. Same thing as I don't think that everyone who has an American flag or Israeli flag in their church is necessarily idolizing America or Israel, but some Christians probably do. Having something in the church that many people venerate strikes me as a distraction from the one we're supposed to be focusing on in church. Both the Orthodox and the Catholic Church have their Marian doctrines. They believe Mary was a perpetual virgin. I don't believe the Bible teaches that, but I don't see why it would necessarily be an abomination for someone to hold a view that, like, lots of Christians hold that view. They hold a lot of the same views the Catholics hold that Protestants generally don't. But I think the main thing that I would dispute with them is that they both claim, the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholics, both claim they are the original church and that their leadership follows an apostolic succession back to the early apostles. The Catholics have said that forever. And frankly, the Eastern Church and the Catholic Church should be the same church. They split like 10 centuries after the time of the apostles. And they were one church until then. And now the Orthodox will tell you they were the originals and the Roman Catholics split off. The Catholics will say, no, we were the originals and the Orthodox split off. And I consider that both groups, long before they split, were pretty far removed from the practices of the apostles mentioned in the scripture. And so, but because they both trace their, their history back through the traditions back many centuries, they can claim what most Protestants cannot, and that is most Protestant denominations don't go back any more than about 500 years, where the Catholic and the Orthodox can say we go back 1,500, or they would say they go back 2,000 years. That's an exaggeration, but the truth is, they've got a longer legacy. But to my mind, they only have that legacy as institutions. And I don't believe Christ set up his church as an institution in the sense that they have it. I believe he set up as a family made up of all the followers of Christ and all the children of God. And you don't have to be institutionally. See, all the institutional forms of worship in the Catholic, the Orthodox, and many of the Protestant churches, I think are simply the trappings of a change that was made after the time of the apostles, when the church ceased to be merely a family of the children of God, followers of Christ, and became an organized religion. You see, I don't see any evidence that Jesus or the apostles decided to set up a religion. Jesus said he came to establish a kingdom, which is a very different thing than a religion. And the apostles, I think, established that. But after the apostles were gone, the thing turned into an organized religion. And that's a very different thing. And when you've got organized religion, you have all kinds of liturgical things that have to be part of that religion. And none of those things, or almost none of them, are things that the apostles established that we know of. Now, they would say the apostles did. We just don't have record of them doing it in the Bible. But they'd say this. We know they did because this was traditionally retained through the ages, but they were apostolic teachings. I don't trust that. I already see in the early second century Ignatius saying things that were contrary to what the apostles said. And so I simply don't trust the traditions of the church to say, well, the Bible doesn't say these things, and it doesn't say the apostles taught these things, but they did. Well, says you, I'm satisfied to go with what Jesus said and what the apostles said, and whatever traditions may have come along later on, it's up to you to accept them or not. I don't. I'd rather just be a follower of Jesus like the early Christians were and not join an established religion like that or any other. Anyway, that's how I would approach the subject. Jim from Texas, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing? Good to talk to you again. Yeah. My question has to do with David Jeremiah has this new book out. It's the disappearance. I guess it's about the return of Christ. And
yeah, I know. All of a sudden, he's advertising it on TV. Yeah, he's advertising it on TV.
People just, I mean, that seems like there's no continuity between in that claim be? And what Acts 10 says, where it says, well, the men, two men stood by in white apparel, and they said to him, men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up? The same Jesus who was taken from you into heaven will come so in like manner as you saw him go.
That's a good point. Let me just bring that up because we're running low on time here. The disciples, of course, were the church. The dispensational view, which arose in the 1800s, says the church is raptured secretly 7 years before Jesus actually comes back visibly. But the angels who first told the disciples about the second coming didn't mention anything about them or other Christians being taken up invisibly. Just mentioned that Jesus would come back visibly in the same way that they'd seen him go. Now, why would they need to know that if, in fact, that wouldn't affect the church? I mean, if the church is going to be gone 7 years before any of that happens, why do we need to know any of that? Why wouldn't he just say, Jesus is going to someday come to the clouds and call you out of the earth, and then there'll be some other things that'll happen? You know, it is true, the early church did not know anything about a pre-trib rapture. The Bible knows nothing about a pre-trib rapture. And I think you make a good point. Those angels apparently knew nothing about a pre-trib rapture and didn't tell the disciples anything about a pre-trib rapture. Just told them about Jesus coming visibly back to earth, which I believe he will. But to separate that from the rapture, I think, is a human tradition that arose just only less than 200 years ago. George from Covina, California. Welcome. We only have a few minutes. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Dana. And listen, I'm currently on a walk. I've been listening to this audio of a video called Marching to Zion by Pastor Steve Anderson, which was put out quite a few years ago. And in fact, it was the video that really caused me to question my dispensational beliefs. And anyway, the point of this question here now is something that I heard of concerning the word or the phrase Shekinah glory, which they state in the video. There's no such description in the Bible of Shekinah glory. In fact, what it does state is that it's from the Jewish Kabbalah, and it talks about it being to do with the femininity of God. So it speaks about God's feminine side, you know, and the speaker, the pastor, he says we have no right to be calling it that, you know, because it's something that's derived from the Kabbalah. Yeah.
Well, I will say this. I knew that the word Shekinah is not found in the Bible. I also knew that the Jews had come up with the term Shekinah to speak of the manifest glory of God. And I think it's usually associated with that glory that filled the tabernacle in Exodus chapter 40 when it was erected and God's glory filled the tabernacle. The priest couldn't stand to minister and so forth. I didn't know it came from the Kabbalah, but I guess it doesn't surprise me because the Kabbalah is not, strictly speaking, biblical. It's a mystical branch of Jewish belief. And I didn't know that the word Shekinah came from it or that it would refer to a feminine side of God. If so, then I have to agree with you. Then the Shekinah is not really a word that Christians should be using. I've used it before only because I knew that the Jews had come to use it to speak of that pillar of cloud and that pillar of fire and the glory of God that filled the temple. They spoke of it, but they didn't in Bible times. So that's a bit of information I didn't know, and I appreciate you sharing it with me. I wish I could talk back and forth with you more, but I'm going to be cut off here in less than 15 seconds. Thanks, George. God bless you. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and access our things and donate if you wish.